What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Grafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. What you're about to hear are the contents of a call that I hosted on Twitter Spaces this past Tuesday evening, only hours after Nancy Pelosi, the U.S. Speaker of the House of Representatives, arrived in Taiwan. For those of you who aren't familiar with Twitter Spaces, it's basically a virtual town hall where anyone can show up, listen in, and if the hosts allow it, ask questions or participate in the conversation directly. I did a formal introduction at the top of the call, and there were three speakers besides me who participated: Dmitry Alperovich, Elbridge Colby, and Jamil Jaffer. Jamil joined about 20 minutes in. He's the only one who hasn't been on the podcast before, and he's someone with extensive experience working in government and national security, including as an associate counsel to former President George W. Bush and as chief counsel and senior advisor to the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Before we get going, I have a small request that I'd like to make that would really mean a lot to me personally, and that would make a huge difference for the show's visibility. And that is if you would just take 10 seconds, literally, that's all it takes, to rate the Hidden Forces podcast on your Spotify or Apple Podcast app. We're trying to reach new listeners with the show, and both Spotify and Apple rank podcasts based in part on the strength and volume of their ratings and reviews. So if you love this show and you think it's a positive force in the world, this is a super easy way to do your part and help get these types of discussions out into the broader public conversation. And I would be so grateful if you took a moment to do that right now. And with that, please enjoy this extremely timely and informative conversation with my guests, Dmitry Alperovich, Elbridge Colby, and Jamil Jaffer. Hey, everyone. Welcome to this evening's Spaces. I know it's a weeknight. Many of you have families, so we're going to try and keep this call brief and use it primarily to bring everyone up to speed on what has been, at least for me, a somewhat confusing story whose, I think, broader contours and implications are what we really want to focus on here tonight. Dmitry Alperovich and Elbridge Colby have joined the space. They're going to be speaking. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Dmitry Grafinas. I'm the host of Hidden Forces, which is one of the top podcasts in business, investing, and geopolitics. You can learn more about the show at hiddenforces.io, where you can also listen to past episodes and subscribe to our premium content. The subject of this call is the arrival today of U.S. Congresswoman and Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, to Taiwan against the expressed opposition, vociferously expressed opposition, I would say, of the Chinese Communist Party in Beijing. Fortunately, there have been no serious incidents directly related to the visit, at least not that I'm aware of thus far. So the focus of this call is more so to gain some perspective on where we are, what this latest diplomatic kerfuffle, if you want to call it that, tells us about the state of U.S.-China-Taiwan relations and what the public should really take away from the larger strategic questions that concern the U.S. and its allies in Asia. My guests on this call have both been on the podcast before. Elbridge Colby was on most recently for a discussion about U.S. national security, including a conversation about Taiwan. He is the co-founder and principal of the Marathon Initiative and the lead architect of the 2018 National Defense Strategy for the United States. And Dmitry Alperovich, as I stated, has also been on Hidden Forces, in fact, twice before. And in his first appearance back in December of last year, he presciently made the case for why he believed the Russian military was preparing the groundwork for an invasion of Ukraine in the winter of this year, which, as we all know, unfortunately, is exactly what happened. Dmitry is the chairman of the nonprofit Silverado Policy Accelerator and the co-founder and former CTO of CrowdStrike, the largest cybersecurity company in the world. So, gentlemen, as I said, we're going to try and keep this as short as we can. Also, Elbridge is in Japan, so I know he's got a tight schedule, but also that makes it very interesting to hear from him and what the perspective is in Asia. Up until today, it wasn't clear if and when the Speaker of the House was going to visit Taiwan. As we all know, in fact, she landed on the island earlier today, wasn't particularly shy about it, tweeted out a picture with her and the delegation. So where do things stand now? Dmitry, why don't you go first?
Sure. Well, I've been publicly opposed to this visit, and I should explain that it's not because I'm sort of some sort of dove on China and think that we should appease the Chinese Communist Party, quite the opposite. But I thought that if you're going to cause a provocation like this, it's worth getting something for it. And it's not clear to me what we're getting for it beyond the optics of the speaker visiting Taiwan. So I would have much preferred that if there was going to be a high-level visit from a U.S. official to Taiwan, which I do think is needed, it would be our military, such as General Milley or head of our Indo-Pacific Command, that would visit and start working closely with the Taiwanese military to schedule training exercises, to start really working on their defense strategy for invasion. That would have been something that would be highly beneficial. This is not, and it comes at a really bad time as well, when we're preoccupied, of course, with the war in Ukraine and trying to build a coalition to isolate Russia. We're asking China to take some measures to abide by our sanctions. So this is really the last, effective time to try to pick a fight with China, in my personal opinion. We're lucky that nothing occurred today. This flight was perhaps the most watched flight of a congressional delegation in history, as everyone was waiting with bated breath to see if there was going to be any interference with the Chinese. The listeners may note that the flight took a really long path all the way around South China Sea, coming into Taiwan from the eastern side, to try to avoid any potential confrontation with the PLA military. So that was probably prudent, but at the same time, probably was not the best indication of America's strength if we wanted to demonstrate it. So, of course, we're not out of the woods yet. While the speaker itself and the congressional delegation are safe, and I expect that they will be able to leave Taiwan tomorrow without incident, what's happening next and how China responds is going to be really important to watch. And the announcements so far are not encouraging, because while the Chinese are clearly not interested in a direct confrontation with us at this point, they are going to take this out on Taiwan, and they've announced a range of measures, economic measures already earlier today to try to put some pressure on the Taiwanese economy. A number of restrictions that they've put on the Taiwanese companies, including ones that are importing biscuits into the mainland, but a range of others as well, primarily in the food sector. The thing that I find most disturbing, and I'm interested in Bridges' view on this as well, is that they're going to have, I believe, a six-day live drill exercise, not just in Taiwanese Straits, but literally all over the island. So if you look at the map where they've announced that they're going to be holding live fire drills, they're essentially blockading all commercial shipping to the island, sort of a practice for a mini blockade, which is incredibly dangerous, because if you talk to experts that are thinking through different war game scenarios of how a Chinese invasion would unfold of the island, you know, they would tell you that it's most likely going to start with a blockade of the island, because the last thing that the Chinese want to do is actually do an invasion of an island of 23 million people and have to fight their way from the beaches up into the mountain regions of Taiwan. A really, really difficult invasion by for any military, especially the Chinese one, that hasn't fought a war since 1979 with Vietnam, a war that did not turn out well for them. But they're going to try to win it without a fight, and they're going to see if a blockade would at least as phase one would accomplish their objectives. So giving them an opportunity to practice it that this provocation has resulted in, I view as a substantial negative. So curious how Bridge sees this, but that's my opinion.
Yeah, Bridge, please go ahead. What are your thoughts on this and where we stand at the moment and to some of the things that Dmitry also mentioned, like the blockade?
Sure. Well, great to be with both of you, Dmitry. My general reaction is similar to Dmitry's. I think the whole situation was ill-advised because the fundamental fact is that we are sort of in a situation of speaking loudly and carrying a small stick. The military balance has eroded dramatically over the last 20, 25 years, and it's sort of reaching a kind of a tipping point, it seems like, in this decade. And frankly, the administration seems to have a similar assessment, given what Bill Burns has been saying and Avril Haines and some of the military assessments and so forth, obviously Phil Davidson. There's been plenty of symbolism about Taiwan. In fact, I would say there's been a surfeit. I mean, the president has talked about it. The State Department, multiple congressional leaders, senior retired people. So I think there's plenty of symbolism. The question is whether we can actually help Taiwan defend itself sufficiently to beat off a Chinese attack. And I have a different view than Dmitry. I mean, we don't know what anybody who says and Dmitry didn't say this, but anybody who says that they know what Xi Jinping or the Chinese leadership are going to do, I just discount because nobody knows. They may not even know themselves, but you know, they have every reason to not give us clarity about how they're address the Taiwan issue, except at the strategic level. I mean, at the macro level, I mean, Beijing has made it very clear. I mean, Xi Jinping has personally and the Chinese leadership have clearly linked the resolution of the Taiwan issue to the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation and the kind of key things that Beijing is talking about as their central policy objective. So, I think once the kind of cat was out of the bag with Speaker Pelosi, I'm not sure that we could kind of do anything but have her go, because it would be obviously a sort of a significant symbol of a step back that was sort of once it was public. I'm not sure there was another course. But, I mean, this is my basic point. I mean, the situation there is exceptionally grave, and it's the one place in the world where a country that's within our defense perimeter, plausibly, we even if we tried our hardest, we might not be able to win. And, you know, the Chinese, I don't think the Chinese are ready yet, because if they were, they either would have invaded or they would have been more likely to precipitate a fundamental crisis that would be a sort of a true showdown, kind of, Berlin style or more. Because they would have had the confidence that they could have won without fighting in that sense. But it seems like they're not far. I mean, if you look at some of the stuff that's, being done on Twitter, I mean, they are practicing blockade options, but they are also practicing both sea and airborne invasion, basically, capabilities. And they've been exercising more effectively as a joint force. So it's true that they haven't fought a war since 1979, but they have such other advantages in terms of quantity and proximity that they may be able to overcome whatever discount that provides. So my bottom line here is we should laser focus on this problem. And, there's a debate. I've been struck actually recently, particularly more on the right side of the spectrum. There's a lot of skepticism or opposition to defending Taiwan. I understand where that comes from. I share a lot of that sentiment, but the fact of the matter is Taiwan is strategically critical. And I think the optics of the Pelosi visit being about global democracy is not actually really focusing on why Taiwan is actually important to Americans, which is, Taiwan is critical to the defense of Japan, of South Korea, of the Philippines. There's no way, or it's going to be exceptionally difficult for what I call an anti-hegemonic coalition to stand up in Asia if Taiwan falls. And the Chinese, if they do Taiwan, they're probably not going to stop right there and then, because they're going to take a lot of heat for it, obviously. So they might as well, point a gun at the head of Manila and Hanoi and so forth. For people who are talking about a kind of an autarky in the United States, on reshoring, U.S. is 20% of global GDP. I mean, the Chinese are going to have control at that point if they gain a hegemonic position in Asia, 50% or more of global GDP. And the European economies are going to be beholden to them. So we are going to be a shrinking proportion of global GDP. Our lives are not going to be the same. And this has, you know, I mean, obviously I sympathize with the fact that, and I support the fact that, that Taiwan is a democracy, but this is not about a global crusade for democracy. This is about the livelihood of Americans and what, you know, being on the, essentially under the control, but under the dominant influence of China, and whether or not that's going to be our future.
So I want to emphasize again that Bridge was on the podcast most recently, and in the second hour, we discussed Taiwan in depth. And this is also a subject that we covered about a year and a half ago with Ian Easton on an episode dedicated to Taiwan. Guys, one of the things I often hear or read about in English translations of Chinese publications is that there's concern around what China broadly sees as an increased level of unpredictability in U.S.-China relations, driven primarily by changes in the American political atmosphere, some of which we all understand are a feature of democratic politics, but some of which are unique to this moment and also, honestly, result from some really confusing statements made by the president himself on the question of Taiwan and whether the U.S. would come to its defense in the event of a Chinese attack, or to even to your guys' point, a blockade of the island. Bridge, you're in Japan at the moment. What is the sentiment in Tokyo right now around this trip and the direction or lack thereof in American foreign policy towards Taiwan and how Beijing and Xi's own agenda for the island factor into that?
I mean, it's a little hard to, for me to say. It's kind of an anecdotal, obviously, perception. My general sense is that the Pelosi visit kind of moved very quickly. It was a bit of a surprise probably to everybody. And so, I mean, it seems like Japan is more in reactive mode. What I will say is more broadly, over the last several years, Japan has very publicly shifted its stance on, you know, the relevance of the security of Taiwan to Japan. They haven't shifted their position on the political status of Taiwan, as far as I can tell. But they've made very clear, I think rightly, that Taiwan is critical to the defense of Japan itself for a variety of reasons. So, you know, I haven't seen the level of urgency from the government of Japan that would logically follow from that perception and the growing threat to Taiwan, but I haven't seen that level of urgency from the United States either. So that's the most troubling thing about the dynamic looked at from here, as far as I can tell.
Well, that kind of leads me to another question I wanted to ask you guys both, which has to do with the status quo. But before I ask that, I do actually want to follow up on the point I made about politics and the uncertainty of American politics and how foreign countries that may not have systems like ours interpret that. Like, for example, how the Chinese may interpret the fact that Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan, and whether or not she could have actually been prevented from going. I mean, I don't mean physically prevented from going, but whether this was something that ultimately the administration sanctioned. So, like, how do you guys think about the political stability or lack thereof, or perceived lack of political stability and continuity of American foreign policy from administration to administration during this time, and how it influences the stability of geopolitics in this greater power competition that both of you have talked about? Maybe Dmitry, go with you first, and then Bridge can answer as well.
Yeah, you know, I actually think that this issue is overblown. I think there's actually a lot of continuity, specifically on our Chinese foreign policy with regards to China, from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. There's been little change. And in fact, you know, in this very divided nation, if there's one thing that there is huge amount of political consensus on, is that China is an adversary, and that it's a growing threat to the national security of this country. I also think that emphasizing too much the fact that Pelosi is part of a different branch of government and certainly has ability to make her own decisions is also something that we shouldn't overemphasize, because let's be real about this. She flew on Milair. She flew on a U.S. Air Force plane. The administration, if it wanted to, could have denied the use of that aircraft, even though obviously it would have caused them a lot of trouble, perhaps politically, to do so. But they could have also come out publicly and said very clearly that they were not supportive of this trip. They didn't do that, even though privately they messaged that they weren't fans of this. So they could have done a lot more if they wanted to indicate to the Chinese and the world that they were opposed to this. They chose not to do so. And that was probably the right decision, you know, given the fact that Nancy Pelosi is known as someone who is very strong-willed. And once she makes a decision, it's hard to dissuade her. You know, if she was intent on going, it was probably the right thing to present a unified front from a U.S. perspective that this is a U.S. government official, a senior U.S. government official that's going.
So, Bridge, I mean, I know you talk to a lot of people in government. As I mentioned, you're the lead architect of the 2018 National Defense Strategy. You have a really good sense of what the general consensus is. What are your views on this and how important the real and or perceived political wrangling in American politics is for China?
I personally, I sort of agree with Dimitri in the sense that I there are a lot of questions about America's obviously very sort of rancorous domestic politics, but I don't see a lot of impact, you know, just empirically on our policy vis-a-vis China or frankly in other elements of our foreign policy. So there's a lot of sort of, you know, there's a fracas, but when it comes down to it, like there's, I mean, and for instance, on our defense policy on Taiwan there or in, and on China, it's been almost like totally consistent across the Trump and Biden administration. And that's not to say that, I mean, there are elements of what the Biden administration is doing that I don't agree with, mostly having to do with implementation of that policy, although that was also a struggle in the Trump administration. But so I don't say that as kind of like, you know, kumbaya, everybody agrees. No, like I just, there's a lot of rancor in American politics, but when you look at what's actually happening, there's a fair amount, I mean, there's a large amount of consistency across the administrations on China, on Taiwan. I mean, Mike Pompeo was just there, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the far bigger problem to me is that you know, is the costs that are going to be entailed to actually be able to defend Taiwan. And that would be certainly in an invasion context, but even if China puts a blockade on the island, you know, the consequences of escalation, I mean, it, you know, and there's been some polling recently that Americans are, you know, they're reluctant to get involved in distant territories. But, you know, if at the end of the day, the Chinese are prepared to let the balloon go up and either invade or blockade in a really meaningful way, and the Americans aren't, they're going to take over Taiwan. I mean, Taiwan's not going to be able to defend itself. That's for sure, I think, going forward. And I don't think anybody, you know, credibly is saying otherwise. So, I mean, I think that's the biggest, and that's, you know, the very frustrating thing to me, and I put this out on a tweet the other day, is just, the whole Pelosi visit is just such an indicator of how our foreign policy our foreign policy debate and discussion has not adapted to the reality, where it's all about the symbolism and about our whether we have the willpower and what it will be seen and the signal it sends. And it's like the big basic question is whether we have a way of defending Taiwan at a level of cost and risk that is tolerable to the American people, and that is increasingly in question. You know, and then, you know, to me in this context, you know, China is, I mean, I'm dating myself a little bit, but like China's like Mike Tyson, we're like George Foreman or whatever, you know, and we're the older guy and like we're kind of taking it for granted. And I mean, pick your, you know, your famous boxer, and he's been hitting the gym hard and we're kind of like talking a big game before the, you know, we get in the ring. And we really, what we should be doing is like hitting it. You know, we should be hitting the gym and maybe talking a lot less and making, you know, flapping our gums less and really focusing on being able to have the, you know, the military resilience, the economic resilience, capability to be able to make defending a Taiwan a rational decision. And that's the real question.
Hey, Dimitri, I actually agree fully with Bridge, but to make this a little bit more lively, I see my friend Jamil Jaffa in the audience here, former Bush administration official. I know he has a very different position from Bridge and I. It might be worth getting him up here to present a different view.
Absolutely. Jamil, can you request to be a speaker? Because I don't actually see you. So just added you as a speaker, Jamil. So feel free to go ahead and give us your view on this question, what we're discussing with Elbridge and Dimitri.
Well, look, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, I get the point that this is a provocative action that Pelosi's taking, that there might not be a lot of sort of net outcomes in the short run. But I think the point is that, you know, China has been increasingly aggressive towards Taiwan. We haven't made clear our national posture, and I get the benefits of strategic ambiguity and the like. But the fact of the matter is this tees up the question, right? Where is the administration on Taiwan? Where is the United States government? Is there a difference between where Congress is and where the White House is? And I'm a big believer in presidential power and that the administration should be the mover on foreign policy. But the reality is they haven't gotten off the mark on this thing. They've been hemming and hawing about Ukraine, and they've sort of slow walked their way into the response we've had there. And the reality is that this moment tees up the question of Taiwan. And frankly, I think there's value in that. And I don't doubt that Bridge is absolutely right. But that Dimitri's right that this can be provocative. But at the same time, I think Bridge has been making the point repeatedly that we need to focus on the very real threat that China poses to our national security and to global security. And Pelosi's visit tees it up right up front.
So does it accelerate the pivot to Asia? Something I know Bridge has been pounding the table on.
Well, I don't think it has. Absolutely. I mean, I think inevitably the entire world, the entire American public is now, or at least those paying attention to the news, are focused on this question to the extent they weren't before. This is a banner day for Bridge in some ways, right? I mean, this is exactly the point he's been making repeatedly, as loud as anybody will listen. So I think this is a moment for us to really focus on. I worry, though, as Dimitri and Bridge have rightly pointed out, that the administration is going to swing and miss. And that's the real concern for me.
What would something like that look like?
A swing and miss?
Yeah.
I think we're watching it happen right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to have Chinese do these exercises that are going to be essentially a dress rehearsal for a blockade, and there's not going to be a response, that's going to be devastating. That's going to be worse than Pelosi canceling her trip. Much, much worse.
See, I actually don't agree with that, right? I don't think we have to respond to the dress rehearsal. We have to be prepared to respond when it actually happens.
Well, how do you differentiate between it actually happening and a dress rehearsal in this case?
Yeah, look, Jamil, if the Chinese shut down commercial shipping in and out of Taiwan for whatever they're saying, 6 days, that is terrible if we allow them to do that. Because what happens if they try to do that again next month and the month after that? And then they decide to extend it to 30 days.
Well, I think the response has to be clear here that we will not accept the blockade of Taiwan, right? We'll be prepared to respond. If they don't, if they continue it past a certain period, then I think we have to respond, right? And I think Bridge, we should got to deal Bridge into this. I'm sure his point is going to be, right, Bridge, that we're not postured to respond. Is that your view, Bridge, right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Jamil, I think you, I mean, one of the reasons I haven't gotten out heavily so much on whether or not Pelosi should go is like, I don't have a firm fix. You may be right, this is net beneficial in the sense that, I mean, I think it would have been better to have planned this out. But if there is a silver lining to this, that it gets people to focus, I'm not sure that's true, but I you might be right. And in any case, we should try to make lemonade out of these lemons. I think, yes, to your question, the biggest question is are we ready? And I'm not, I mean, this is the thing. We don't know, like nobody really knows because.
Well, Bridge, we know we're not ready. We know that Taiwan is not ready to defend itself. We know that they don't have enough missiles. We know that they don't have the right strategy. We know that they don't have the right training. We know that they don't have the right level of integration with us. We know all of this. So wouldn't it be better to do these types of provocations much later when we are ready?
That would have been my recommendation, but we are where we are. But here's the other thing. We don't know if the PLA is ready either. So Taiwan is manifestly not ready. And I don't think we're ready either. But as everybody likes to point out, and including you pointed out, an amphibious invasion is very difficult. And to your point, I agree with Jamil. I mean, blockade is an act of war, right? And if they do that, one of the reasons I think a blockade is a bad idea for China is they kind of allow us the initiative. At some point, we're going to have to flag, flag ships with U.S. flags and escort them in, and we'll be able to do that on our terms. And that's going to kind of put the burden of escalation onto China. It's one of the reasons I think a blockade is not going to be as attractive to them without getting into all the details. But I think if they were really ready themselves, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen over the next few weeks. But I mean, there has been, one of the things I've been struck by is the administration, and I've got a piece coming out on this hopefully next week, but the administration's assessment of the the near-term risk has seems to have gone up quite significantly. Like last year when Phil Davidson gave his testimony in the spring of 21 that China had a window, you know, was looking to resolve the issue by, or have the ability to resolve the issue by 27, I think there were a lot of eyes that were rolling, including in the administration. That seems to have changed. I mean, people who are very close and part of the Senate, I mean, you would know better than I, Dimitri, but who are part of the kind of core team in the Biden team, like of Real Haines and Bill Burns, have been saying pretty clearly, I mean, my understanding is that Haines said in the spring of this year that the threat to Taiwan is now acute. And Burns's comments the other day at Aspen, you know, that China would use overwhelming force, you know, and that wanted to have the capability, and that Xi Jinping's, you know, interest in doing so has not waned at all. I mean, these are all significant indicators. So the biggest problem, though, is that, I mean, you know, I've gone back and forth with a lot of you about this, is like the administration has almost doubled the force posture in Europe. It's not increasing defense spending. It's not dramatically overhauling the military from year to year. In fact, if anything, it's divesting of a lot of, yes, older legacy capabilities, but that would be more important in the near, in the nearer term. And I think now we're at the point where we're going to have to do both the longer and the term. I mean, 8 years ago, whatever it was, when Bob Work was rightly talking about the third offset and starting to draw attention to these problems, we could take a knee rationally at that point because it was manifest that the Chinese lacked the capability to do something. We are not in that position anymore. And so now I think we're going to have to cover down over the nearer and the longer term. And this to me, and I'm not somebody, and Jamil knows this, I'm not somebody who really, in my heart, I want to dramatically increase the defense budget. But I don't see how we are going to be able to do this without increasing the budget, especially if we're not willing to fundamentally do a lot less in the Middle East and Europe. And that's got to be the Japanese and the Taiwanese too. And yet that's not happening. So that's what that's the kind of the Mike Tyson analogy with Foreman, is like we're beating our chests, but are we really doing what's necessary? It doesn't look to me like we are.
Well, I think this is exactly my point. And I think, Bridge, you made it exactly right, which is, you know, we aren't ready. Dimitri, you're right. We're not ready. We're not postured, nor are the Taiwanese. And the answer is, if Chinese start a blockade tomorrow, 3 days, 5 days, 6 days, whatever it is, what do you think we're about to do? We're going to get ready. Bridge is right. We have to eventually flag ships with U.S. flags and escort them in. That means we have to be prepared to do that. This administration had no plan, has no plan, is not going to get us ready to get into that, to be prepared for that fight. If this tees that up, great. So be it. We're going to need it at some point anyways.
And if it doesn't, then we'll blink?
No, we're not blink now. I mean, as you pointed out, there's no blinking here. China's just not going to do it long term. We're not going to be able to deal with it right now. But if it allows us to prepare, that's the right answer. You want us to be ready, right? This administration is not going to get ready. Is there any sign that they're preparing to get ready for this conflict? This will tee that up.
The thing is, they say they are. That's what's mystifying to me. Like, they've said that Taiwan is the pacing scenario repeatedly. Hicks has said that they're going to have a denial defense as their standard. But I don't see the resources being allocated from the outside. Maybe I'm not clued in. But I mean, at some level, we would be able to see it because, you know, these kind of big muscle movements are visible. So that's what... And then they say we can walk and chew gum at the same time. And I just don't think that's a serious policy.
The one thing that is very clear to me is that we need high-level military-to-military relationships with Taiwan, not just having some major colonel over there. We need general officer-level communications. If you look at the one lesson from Ukraine that I think is the most critical, is the reason why Ukrainians are doing so well is because we've been there since 2014. We've been training them. We've been making connections to provide them with real-time intelligence. Obviously, there's a huge supply of weapons coming in there. We don't have any of that really established to a sufficient level with Taiwan, and we need to work on that 5 years ago. It's already too late, but we have to start immediately.
Guys, how much of this, it's kind of unfair to separate these, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. How much of this is an issue of strategic vision and not having the right vision? And how much of it is a mistaken or lack of urgency, the wrong timeline on thinking about when something like this could happen?
I think we're locked in a mindset of that we can't be, you know, we can't be challenged directly by a great power. I mean, I guess. I mean, that's what our foreign policy discussion looks like. And, you know, I mean, frankly, people go back to history in 1979, but I mean, the last time we fought the Chinese, we were... to be generous to our results, we were fought to a standstill. In some ways, they defeated us because they pushed us back from the Yalu in the Korean War. And that was when they were a relatively primitive, you know, force. I think we should be, we shouldn't be sitting on our haunches, that we're definitely going to do better. And I mean, for instance, like the performance of the Russians, Mike Coffin, I think, has made this point rightly with Dmitry and others like Dave Johnson. I mean, we would run out of munitions really quickly too. We don't know how we would perform in a really high end context. I mean, we've had problems with the 7th Fleet and, you know, the Bonhomme Richard, the damage control, the fire control situation. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate the point, but my sense is that our forces would perform at a materially higher level than the Chinese. But I mean, it's, again, a historical analogy. You know, Martin van Creveld, the military historian, he had a famous book where the Germans were man for man much better than the Allied armies, but the Allied armies had, you know, numbers, right? The Chinese have numbers and position and proximity and focus and lower labor costs. So like we should be hitting the gym.
So Bridge, actually, this question is directed at you because I know this is something you've written quite a bit about. And I want to kind of wrap into the timely question of now. First of all, and this is, I guess, a question for all of you guys, how do we manage the situation now? And then assuming we don't get a blockade or something that is too escalatory, what do you think, and again, Bridge, this is specifically to you, but anyone can answer it, what do you think the correct policy should be going forward? And what should U.S. policy be in Europe in terms of having to make some of the hard choices between the two different theaters and the pivot to Asia in trying to protect Taiwan, if in fact we agree that Taiwan is an essential part of any strategic defense of Asia?
Sure. I mean, so a couple things. First of all, I think we should focus on, to Dmitry's point, on the substance of our ability to defend Taiwan along with their efforts, not the symbolism. There's been plenty of symbolism. I don't think we need to abandon strategic ambiguity as a formal policy. We just need to make it clear within our defense establishment that they should be prepared to defend the island. Those things are somewhat in tension, but, you know, we're all grownups here. That's the policy, right? There's no need to shift off the policy. We shouldn't signal a fundamental change on the political status of Taiwan. In some sense, that can give China an excuse or a pretext when we're not in a position to do that. So we should focus there. I mean, I think we should, unfortunately, I think we are likely to have to spend more on defense in order to get the kind of capability, because this, even though I don't want to do it, it's going to be a lot cheaper than if we get our tails handed to us over a Taiwan fight, which would only be the beginning of the problem, not the end. And I mean, you can go into that if you want. And then I think we ought to do a couple other things. I mean, the administration has made clear in its national defense strategy that, and Hicks said this specifically, we have a major war force planning construct, which is to say we are not in a position to fight two major wars on a roughly concurrent timeline. So that requires prioritization and choice. We don't abandon Europe, but we need to make it clear to the Europeans that they will assume the primary responsibility for the conventional defense of NATO Europe, and that we will be prepared to help them with whatever assets are available that do not compromise the defense of Taiwan. And I think that's a very straightforward thing. And I think Europeans, you know, especially given the fact that the Russian military has clearly declined in its fighting prowess, at least for the foreseeable future. I mean, Haines said herself that the Russians are going to lack the ability to wage a two-front war for the, you know, years to come. And that the war and the conflict in Ukraine is likely to be protracted. So I don't even know what our additional forces in Europe are supposed to be there for. Meantime, the Poles are spending 5%. Then what we need to do is we need to get our allies and Taiwan to really, really focus. And we need to put a lot of pressure on them. I mean, this is something that we've really gotten out of practice on. We need to be able to provide an adequate degree of reassurance that we're not going to necessarily, that we're not going to, you know, just walk away, but intense pressure on Japan, on Germany to meet its Zeitenwende commitments soon, on other countries, you know, particularly the Northern and Western European countries. And I think we should enable countries like France that want to take a more leading role, right? So that we can offload some of these responsibilities and take a more of a supporting role. And then with Taiwan, I do think the administration is right to press them. It's just ridiculous that they're, I mean, it's mind boggling to me that Taiwanese are not insisting that their government spend, I mean, they're spending 2% and they face a truly existential threat. And I think a lot of people, when I was growing up in Hong Kong, I always point this out, a lot of the Hong Kong Chinese had a second passport because they didn't know what was going to happen after 1997, and they were right to do so. I mean, Taiwanese are acting like this isn't going to happen. I mean, if you're a DPP party member, if and when China takes over, I mean, they're not going to treat you well, right? I mean, why would you be spending 2%? And then even beyond that, why are they not implementing Admiral Lee's overall defense concept? They need an asymmetric defense focused on defending against invasion, and then as well as being resilient to a... They don't seem to be doing that. So this is, you know, we need to be kind of like all business about this series of things. And then I think we sort of speak softly but carry a big stick. Once we have a big stick, then we can start speaking loudly again. But until then, I would be more, you know, prudent about it.
Either you guys want to jump in, or I can follow up with another
question. Yeah. I mean, okay. I broadly agree with Bridge. I mean, I think the one that we really need to lean on is Taiwan. And I agree that they have a big political problem because their government is represented. It's a democracy, and it is representative broadly of the opinion of their people. And their people do not think that they have a threat. I mean, I was very much afraid that if there was going to be a forceful response today or in the near future, the likely scenario would be the attempt to take the Kinmen Island, that is one of the outlier islands that is right off the mainland. It is literally 10 kilometers away. You can see the mainland from the island. It doesn't have significant coastal defense capabilities. And Chinese had a show of force today, or yesterday, I guess, their time, with a huge number of amphibious vehicles that they, armored vehicles that they brought to the shore, to the beach, literally just across from the Kinmen Island. And you had reporters that were interviewing people on the island, and they were saying, oh, we're not worried about anything. Nothing's going to happen, and Chinese are our friends anyway, and we trade with them, and there's no risk to us. So, you know, that is indicative of the overall feeling, unfortunately, across much of the Taiwanese population, that there is no threat, that their economic ties to the mainland will save them from any invasion. And this is all just the U.S. imagination. In many ways, this is not unlike what we were hearing from many of the Ukrainians before the war launched, that many did not believe until February 24th that war was coming. Luckily, they were still prepared, but the Taiwanese are not. And honestly, I'm running out of ideas of how to get them to get serious about their own defense.
Well, that was actually... Sorry, Jamil, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say that I actually think Dimitri and Bridge are both exactly right on this, which is the Taiwanese have got to take on more responsibility. They have to recognize what a threat they face. But I'm a little more willing to sort of speak a little bit more loudly than I think maybe Bridge and Dimitri might be. If, in fact, that gets the Taiwanese to do what is necessary to prepare for what is almost at some point inevitable, right? And so from my perspective, if Pelosi, you know, pressing the envelope and going there is what gets the administration, you know, off the mark, makes them realize that the situation we're in with our javelins and other defense capabilities that we've provided to Ukraine is not sufficient. We need the defense industrial base capabilities. We need that investment now to keep ourselves defensible, to be able to actually fight a conflict, even one major conflict in Asia. We need to be able to rapidly reconstitute our capabilities, be able to deploy forces at long range, and actually, frankly, get basing rights closer in and use those more effectively. We're not carrying out that policy. No matter what the administration says, we're not carrying out the national security strategy that Bridge correctly laid out. And unfortunately, we're seeing the consequences of that now. So I'm a little more willing to take a little bit more bluster now if that pushes us to where we need to be, because without that, to be frank, this administration simply isn't going to do it. It's not a knock on them. It's just the reality of where they're at.
So with the invasion, the recent invasion of Ukraine, the threat of Russia on the eastern border of Europe galvanized the Europeans and NATO members to really reprioritize their national securities and to increase their own spending on defense. Obviously, we're not talking about an imminent invasion of Taiwan right now, but we are talking about other possible scenarios, including a blockade, which is an act of war and highly escalatory. Would something like that, or something proximate like that, actually have a similar galvanizing effect in Asia? In other words, is the constitution of the Asian alliance and America's partners in Asia sufficiently similar so that we could actually see this turn out to be a net positive, despite the fact that no one actually wanted it to happen? When I say this, I mean the trip and the way it all came together.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, it's a better galvanizing moment than the galvanizing moment it took in Ukraine, right? It took an actual invasion for the Europeans to get off the mark and start doing something. It took an actual invasion and thousands dying for the U.S. to get off the mark and start doing something, supplying even more. Yes, the Trump administration began supplying weapons. Yes, the Biden administration did a little bit more and has added on and has really gotten the game going. And they've done a great job, you know, bringing our alliance together in terms of financial pressure and the like. But it took an actual invasion. We don't want to see that happen in Asia, in the Taiwan scenario. And so if Nancy Pelosi's visit is that defining moment, or at least moves the ball down the road, hallelujah.
So I have a question from Chris Krebs. So Chris's question is essentially, with the invasion of Ukraine that we saw, as we just discussed, that we saw a forceful and unified response from the business community, where companies abandoned the Russian market. That was an easy decision. It was a small market share, limited but not insignificant supply chain dependencies. How do we think about businesses' response in a China invasion of Taiwan? Anyone want to take that?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really tough. Russia was the easy scenario. And even with Russia, you still have tons and tons of companies, particularly European companies, that have not pulled out. And those that have pulled out haven't, in some cases, done so meaningfully, i.e. they may have suspended operations, but not permanently shut them down. In some cases, they're still paying salaries for people. With China, it's going to be much more difficult, and there's going to be much more resistance. And look, you know, even with Russia, when you look at U.S. government response, European government response, what have we done? The very first thing we've done is made sure that any sanctions placed upon Russia exclude the oil and gas sector because of the devastating impact that would have on the world economy. So even with the war crimes, even with the, you know, blatantly illegal invasion, we said the economy comes first and we're not going to touch that. Well, if that's the threshold for taking any sort of economic action on China, well, guess what? You're going to have a very limited number of sanctions on China because virtually everything that they do is critical to the world economy. Now, I do think the one thing that's going to be different is that the U.S. and the Europeans have explicitly, and rightly so in my opinion, rejected the idea that we would fight Russia for Ukraine. I don't think that would be true for Taiwan. In fact, right now, on at least three occasions, if not five, has said that we will defend Taiwan if it comes to it, even though it's not official U.S. policy. I do think it's the right policy. And if we're at war with China over Taiwan, then I think many of the economic considerations do go out the window. But that's what it would have to get to.
Yeah, and Dimitri, I've got to jump off. Maybe I'll just say briefly if there's anything else you want me to address before that, but before I leave. But I mean, Dimitri would know better than I. But my distinct impression is that, I mean, two things: one, the costs of doing of detaching from the Chinese economy would be a lot higher. So I'm very skeptical that there would be the degree of effort. And by the same token, China is much more economically resilient. I mean, you know, as people like Edward Luttwak are pointing out, they have food, you know, exposure on things like food and energy. But then, of course, they produce something like 90% of some of our pharmaceuticals. So there's kind of a mutual assured destruction element to the economic warfare piece. And I mean, you know, I think one of the clear lessons of the despite all the attention to it, one of the clear lessons of the Ukraine conflict is that the economic sanctions are not determinative. I mean, what's kept Ukraine going is the Ukrainians' own fighting prowess, the arming, you know, giving them weapons, and then the training that Dimitri referred to. So, I mean, we are not going to, I mean, I assume that Xi Jinping is thinking about the macroeconomic consequences in determining whether or not to roll the dice on Taiwan. But I think probably once they've decided to go, economic sanctions are already baked in. And they're very, very unlikely to be effective. And I also don't think they're a good strategy for the American people, which is why we need a military capability for denial.
Bridge, thank you so much for making the time. As I mentioned, Bridge is in Japan right now. He's also the author of a phenomenal book called Strategy of Denial. As I also mentioned, he was recently on the podcast a couple episodes ago. I highly recommend you guys check that out. And the second hour is when we discuss Taiwan. Bridge, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
So again, I see, I also want to be sensitive to people's time. I know that everyone's got a limited amount of time, and my two guests that we started the conversation off with both have a limited time tonight. So here, I have a question, guys. And I feel like a kind of very basic question that maybe a lot of people are wondering about, which is, why has Taiwan increasingly become a focus of the media? How much of it is being driven by political forces in the United States? How much of it is strategic? How much of it is being driven by China? How much of it is being driven by the media? Just something to talk about. I mean, this is a very common thing. We all know that when you talk about Taiwan, you get a lot of viewers. There's a kind of framework for that in people's heads. It feels like something is changing fundamentally in the status quo. Is that true? And what is driving that? I'm curious. Whoever wants to take that question, go ahead.
Well, I think what's changing is that China has become more bellicose. You're seeing what they're doing in their diplomatic efforts with Wilford diplomacy, with Xi's belligerent rhetoric, and that there is an overall feeling that is now publicly acknowledged by senior U.S. government officials like Avril Haines and others that the risk to Taiwan is growing in terms of an invasion, and is at its highest since the last time the Chinese tried to invade disastrously back in the 50s. So that's what's driving that. And of course, Taiwan's importance in the United States is essential. It has always been essential due to its geography, that it is in that famous first island chain of islands. That if the Chinese are able to occupy it, they essentially are able to project power across the Western Pacific and will make it very difficult to defend Japan, to defend the Philippines. It will make it very difficult for the United States to operate in that region uncontested, as we've been doing for so many decades. And then, of course, in recent years, in the last two decades, Taiwan has also become a major center of semiconductor production. So if you want to talk about economic damage, any damage to the fabs of TSMC and other suppliers in Taiwan would have an immediate devastating effect on the world economy as well. So I think that's the reason why we're paying such close attention to it.
Well, go ahead, Jamil.
Yeah, and I do think, you know, to Dimitri's point, like the American people are really waking up to this, the threat that China poses in the region, but also globally. It's not just, the pandemic and the realization about our supply chains when it comes to pharmaceutical precursors and PPE. We've seen the challenges with the supply chain shortages across the economy, particularly in semiconductors and the car market. So the American people are increasingly, awake to the concern about supply chains and to the point that we saw Congress pass the CHIPS Plus Act. I know there are issues with that. I know not everybody agrees. But we see Congress respond to the American people's waking up to this. And as a result, they're more attuned to it. Increasingly, both the Trump rhetoric and the rhetoric coming out of Congress, I think accurate rhetoric. I don't mean to use the term rhetoric in any sort of negative form. But the American people have heard it. They're listening. And they're paying attention. They do see China as a larger threat than perhaps before. And so this Taiwan situation is, I think, a clarifying moment. But I think it's in the context of a larger awakening of the American public to the very real threat that China poses and the economic interactions that we have that make really addressing it that much more challenging.
So Jamil, actually, so for people that are not familiar, you're referring to the CHIPS and Science Act of 2022, which recently passed both House of Congress and I believe is still awaiting the president's signature.
He just signed it today.
Just signed it. Okay, great. So for people that don't know, what is the purpose of this bill and how significant is it? Is it only as significant as the larger strategy, or can we see actually some real impact as a result of it?
Yeah, let me take that. I've been actually working on this issue for a couple of years now. I know Jamil's been very involved as well. So here's the problem that we've had. Over the last two decades, many American companies that used to be producing chips in this country throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s decided that it was best to get out of the manufacturing game that was very capital intensive and with relatively low margins. And it was best to go up the chain, the value chain, and to focus on design. So as a result, you had numerous companies that have popped up that are designing chips. Many of them are in the United States, NVIDIA, Qualcomm, Apple, and many, many others. But none of them, except for Intel, are producing their own chips. Intel is really the last one. And many of them have sourced that production to this company in China, TSMC, that is one of the world's largest companies. And As a result, we have this incredible dependency on all sorts of semiconductors, from advanced to more legacy ones, on TSMC, and increasingly also on China, because China has been investing in this area extensively, particularly in the last 10 years. Their market share has been growing as well. And that's a huge national security issue. It's a direct national security issue if you're dependent on chips coming out of China, or even on chips coming out of Taiwan, if Taiwan falls, that chips could be used in your weapon systems, could be used in other national security implications. But even from an economic security perspective, you don't want to be beholden to China. You don't want to have them have you over a barrel. So as a result, you had a bipartisan effort, one of the few things that is passing right now with the bipartisan support, to invest in domestic production of semiconductors. And this bill, with $52 billion of direct taxpayer money being granted mostly to industry to build fabs in the United States, with some of the money going to R&D as well, development of newer cutting-edge technologies, and additional tax breaks for manufacturers of semiconductors on top of that, about $20 billion on top of the 52. That bill has passed and has been signed by the president, I believe, today. The challenge with that bill is twofold, and I'm broadly supportive. I know Jamil is as well. This is an area that we need to invest in. But we have to appreciate that as much money as it sounds, $52 billion is unfortunately a drop in the bucket. China is going to be investing about $200 billion over the next 10 years. The needs of the industry are over $1 trillion. $50 in some money is not going to get us to chips independence. It's not even going to increase our market share to even 50%. It's going to be much, much lower, even with that investment. So that's problem number one. And the solution to that, of course, is not to spend more money, because we don't have more money to spend. We're already in massive debt, but to really work strategically with others, other allies, including those in Europe that are interested in spending money. Korea is a huge producer of semiconductors, with Samsung being one of the leading fab manufacturers, Japan, Israel, and others, to invest. And so that altogether we can eclipse the investment that China is making. We alone cannot invest as much as China can, but we and our allies together can absolutely do so. And the second thing that we should be focused on is making sure that companies can't just take that taxpayer money and turn around and invest in China. There are some guardrails in the bill, and we're very glad to see those. But frankly, we need to strengthen those and make sure that, if you're focused on winning a race, there are two ways to do so. One way is to run faster than the other guy. The other way is to try to slow them down. And we need to be doing both, and we need to be really serious about slowing down Chinese ability to produce chips, so that they can actually be beholden to us, so that we would have leverage over them and use that as part of a strategy to deter an invasion of Taiwan. And one way we can do that, one of the few levers of power we have over China today, is that all of the advanced equipment, all of the advanced tooling that you need to manufacture chips, which is really some of the most advanced equipment that man has ever made, is really manufactured in three countries. It is manufactured here in the United States with a few companies like Applied Materials and Lam that are the leaders in that space, a company in the Netherlands called ASML that manufactures really unique ultraviolet equipment that you need for specifically advanced chip production, and a couple of companies in Japan, Tokyo Electric and NEC. And if none of those companies are selling to China, China will not be able to build a single fab in their country. And they will not be able to produce that equipment perhaps for decades, if ever. And they've been trying, trust me, and they've not been able to accomplish it, despite all the theft of IP that they've engaged in and so forth. So that's something that I think we really need to get serious at, is looking how do we stop China from producing their own chips, remaining dependent on us. And that's one way we can save Taiwan without firing a shot, which is in everyone's interest.
Jamil, I don't know if you want to jump in on that last point. Otherwise, I have a question to follow up with.
Yeah, no, look, I agree 100% with Dimitri on that last point, which is, we ought to be thinking about you know, a COCOM or a Wassenaar type arrangement where we get together our allies. And as Dmitry rightly pointed out, there's only a handful of allies we really need to coordinate with if we're going to shut down China's access to some of this tooling. I think the biggest challenge we face is there are, as Dmitry well knows, American producers who still want to be and have access to, want to be in and have access to the Chinese market. And that's the real challenge. And so we've set a current floor for at a certain size. It's right to say that's not the right, it's not necessarily the right measure, but it's a debate we ought to have and we ought to work with our allies on. I think Dmitry's 100% right on that.
So I have another question, guys. Actually, I have two. And again, I'm trying to leak these out so that everyone can manage their time. Again, because I know that everyone's time is limited. It's weeknight, et cetera, et cetera. The question has to do with templates, historical templates. So I wonder if the template that people have in their mind is the Cold War, the closest thing they can reach for in terms of trying to understand where we are today. But how useful is that analog, considering how much more interconnected the U.S. economy is with the Chinese economy? And maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing for us and for managing the contours of this potential conflict. And also, which is definitely not a positive thing for the U.S., the size and sophistication of the Chinese economy. So that's the general question. How useful is that historical template? How prepared are we really for the world that we're stepping into, given some of the fundamental distinctions and differences between the Soviet Russia of the early 1940s, the post-World War II Soviet Russia, and the modern Chinese political economy?
Yeah, I think there's no question that we're in Cold War 2.0. I actually hosted a couple of years ago a debate on this with historian Neil Ferguson and geopolitics expert Ian Bremmer. It's on Silverado's YouTube page for anyone that wants to see a really fascinating debate. In my opinion, I'm squarely in Neil Ferguson's camp that we are in Cold War II. But Cold War II is very different from Cold War I, just like World War II is very different, was very different from World War I. So the analogy is helpful only in the sense that it aligns everyone with the idea that China is not a friend of the United States, and that we need to start getting serious about confronting China and avoiding a hot war. But that's probably where the similarities end. And as you rightly point out, Dmitry, the economic situation is very different. There's no ideological component to this fight. I would say there's no even sort of a world domination component to it. I don't think China is interested in the imperialist ambitions that the Soviet Union had to spread communism around the world. They just want the rest of the world to be beholden to them economically. So it's a very, very different challenge in every respect. But as a sort of a galvanizing idea that we do have to get our economy, get our industry, get our government, get our population to start focusing on this issue, I think it is useful to think about it in those terms.
Do you guys worry at all that we may be exaggerating this threat? And when I say we, clearly there's a distinction between where the public is or where the public was, where it is now, and where some of the more hawkish folks are on this issue. But when thinking about the, quote, threat that China poses, how do you think about that possibility that we could legitimately be provoking them and also stoking their anxieties? I'm just curious what you guys think. Jamil, Dmitry, either one of you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a very real possibility that we are walking ourselves into more of a fight than we need to have. I think for all the reasons you've laid out, Dmitry has rightly laid out why this is a Cold War 2.0, but a fundamentally different Cold War 2.0. The economic linkages make it a lot less likely that we end up in a major hot war. However, I think there's a significant chance because of the way we're handling the current situation, and frankly, the way that we've handled prior fights, whether it comes to what's happening in Ukraine, Russia, or our disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan and the like, I think there's a potential for strategic and at least tactical miscalculation, particularly on the Chinese side, right? Where they perceive that we're not ready for a fight, that we're not willing to do it, in part because that is the rhetoric we keep saying every time we talk about ending endless wars. That is not going to help move the ball forward on deterring Chinese bad action as it failed to deter Russian bad action. And so, you know, in my view, we can afford to be now I'll admit to being, you know, one of the more hawkish people as you described, Dmitry, there. But But, you know, I will say I think we can afford to be a little more bellicose, because I think the economic linkages make a large-scale war less likely. But I think we have to deter effectively, and you can't deter effectively if the other side doesn't understand what your red lines are, doesn't understand what happens if they cross them, and doesn't believe that they cross them, you will actually extract a real cost that is not just some US sanctions.
Yeah, so this actually makes me think of another question that combines this and a couple of other observations. And when I say this, I mean trying to intuit the intentions of another actor and also the risk calculus. So the Chinese certainly don't want to do something that's going to significantly adversely impact them economically. And to sort of combine the two conversations, one on the blockade and the possibilities of a blockade, which I still, you know, I don't know if it's even possible to handicap the odds of it, but I'd be curious to know what you guys think of that. But to combine the observations about a potential blockade, as well as what Chris Krebs brought up in terms of the private sector's response, how concerned should the Chinese be? And what do you think the possibility would be that if, in fact, they were to conduct a blockade, that this would really cause a significant negative response on the part of America's Asian partners and actually galvanize a kind of strengthening of America's alliances and, for lack of a better word, strategic framework in Asia, given the fact that there's no existing structure like NATO?
Well, look, the first thing you have to realize is that China has been preparing for this invasion scenario since 1949, right? So it's been 70 plus years that they've been thinking about this, that they've been wargaming it, that they've been strategizing about the right tools that they need and how various parties might respond. That doesn't mean that they've thought everything through and that, you know, their plan is perfect by any means, but they've been focused on it a lot longer than we have and a lot deeper. So I don't think that they're going to rush into it. I think the Pelosi trip, the reason I was concerned about it is that it presents a perfect opportunity for them to sort of ease into it. You know, now that they've announced this, you know, kind of mini blockade for a few days of these live fire exercises, they're going to see what the response is, right? And if they get serious pushback, maybe they pull back. If they don't, maybe they push further. And that's where I begin to worry that this slow encroachment on Taiwanese sovereignty, on Taiwanese ability to work with the world that they've been working on from a diplomatic perspective now for a couple decades, really successfully making sure that Taiwan is completely isolated in the diplomatic sphere, where virtually no country in the world, except really a few Pacific Island nations, have recognition of Taiwan. Complete change from what it was in the 70s when most countries recognized Taiwan and not mainland China. So I do worry about sort of their slow rolling effort to take over China that will culminate ultimately with an invasion. I think they're solely focused on this for a huge number of reasons, partly historical reasons, sort of reunification, partly domestic reasons that they want to use this to stoke up nationalism and keep the population united, even as the economic situation perhaps is turning in China with the demographic collapse that they're now facing as a result of the one-child policy. But I think there's an even more fundamental issue with their desire to have Taiwan, and that comes down to raw geopolitics, that, you know, they have aspirations to be a great power. They're certainly on the path to become a great power, and they cannot fulfill those aspirations without owning Taiwan. The reason is that without Taiwan, without breaking through the first island chain, they're surrounded. The United States Navy today could completely cut off all shipping in and out of China easily because they're blockaded in the first island chain. With them owning Taiwan, the situation would be very, very different. So I think part of the reason that they want to own Taiwan is that insecurity and that ambition to become a global power. But part of it, obviously, is nationalism and historical reasons, too.
Okay, so Jamil, I don't know if you have any thoughts. And then I have kind of one question to wrap it up, even though I could keep asking questions. I mean, I have another question that I would like to ask about what it would take to kind of change strategic direction, how important public education is, like where the impetus for change would come from. But let's put that aside My last question is kind of more practical and immediate, which is, okay, we talked about possible blockade. Again, no idea what the likelihood of something like that is, but we all expect some kind of response. And yet at the same time, after the United States seized Russia's central bank's foreign exchange reserves and levied some pretty serious sanctions on the Russian economy, we all, many of us expected to see some kind of material response. Certainly, cyber attacks were something that we were looking out for. Nothing really materially happened, at least not something that sort of got elevated to the to anything that sort of would have elicited an escalatory response. So what do you guys expect to come out of this? Like, what should we be looking for? What should we be concerned about? And how should something like that be managed? Like, is there, what are your thoughts? Jamil, why don't you go first, actually, since you were not speaking earlier?
Well, look, I mean, I think that there's a variety of responses we could see. I think, you know, you all have discussed a number of them here, the blockade and the like. On the cyber side, I mean, we have seen, obviously, the purported attack on the Taiwanese, office of the president and the like. But, you know, I think that we're likely to see a slow drip. I think what Dmitry is right about is that this is the Chinese are going to play the long game here. They've made clear not happy about this. They're going to slowly start to raise the pressure. I don't think we're going to see a dramatic response, an immediate escalation. I think they're managing their time. And I actually think that, you know, they're playing this in a very smart way. They've got bellicose rhetoric, right, trying to push back. But in the long run, I think what they realize is there's a lot, and Dmitry's made this point before, which is that there's a lot they can achieve without an actual invasion, right? And there's a long space between now and invasion if they want it to be. And so as a result, they can put a lot more pressure on without, you know, poking the bear, as it were, or poking the eagle in this case. And so they may want to, they may be tempted to, but I think they're going to play the long game. And I think their calculation is if they play their cards right, they can achieve a lot of the goals they want to achieve without getting us in the fight. And even though I don't think they actually are worried about us, you know, actually, you know, getting in the fight, I think they don't think we have the guts to do it. I don't think they're actually waiting for us. I think they're taking their time because they're preparing for the day they can actually, conduct an invasion, completely establish immediate air and on the ground superiority, and prevent a long-term, rebellion or long-term, coin operation on the island itself. So that's my instinct about how this thing plays out in the short run. I don't know if the question directly, but that's sort of my instinct right now.
Let me answer the long-term question, by the way, or the medium-term question. Amphibious invasions are literally the hardest military operation you can possibly execute. And experience is key. China has no experience in that. It has no experience in recent memory fighting wars. I don't believe there's a single senior officer in the Chinese military that's still in the Chinese military that has even participated in active combat, given that the last war was in 1979. So they've got a huge problem on their hands executing a highly, highly complex operation against an island of 23 million people that is somewhat defended, although should be defended a lot better. And we can make it pretty much impossible. If we flood Taiwan with coastal defense batteries, with missiles, with mines, that would pretty much make that invasion an impossibility. Look at what's happening in Ukraine, right? You had two missile strikes, Neptune missiles, which are fairly basic cruise missiles, indigenously produced in Ukraine, that have sunk the flagship of the Black Sea, of the Russian Black Sea, the Moskva. And since then, you've had the entire Black Sea basically hightail out of any area where they can be even within missile range of Ukraine. In fact, they've even left recently the port of Sevastopol in Crimea and relocated to Novorossiysk on the other side of the Black Sea. That's how much they're afraid of just a few missile batteries that the Ukrainians have now been able to procure from the West, in addition to the indigenously produced Neptune. Imagine if there were 1,000 or 1,500 missiles that were mobile from mobile launchers that could not be easily destroyed through airstrikes and missiles from the Chinese side. That would pretty much make that invasion an impossibility because they would be able to sink most of the landing ships long before they even are able to cross the straits. That's what we should be focused on supplying to the Taiwanese. That's what we,
frankly need to be in the time is in the very, very stark terms that that's what they are going to get, not the F-16s and other aircraft they're trying to procure from runways that will be destroyed within the first hours of the war and will be turned useless, not Abrams tanks that are not going to see any actions because if at that point, if the Chinese are already on the beaches, it's game over. And the problem is that the Taiwanese military is not serious about its defense. You have senior military leaders, senior defense officials that are more interested in prestige programs, big ticket programs that will make them look macho, you know, internally and to their populations, and not focused on asymmetric capabilities that are core to their defense. And we have to get tough with them. We have to prohibit them from buying those useless systems. And part of that includes standing up to our own defense sector that is interested in or selling them those big ticket items, even if it doesn't contribute me to defense. And we have to force on them the systems that will actually make a difference.
So guys, I really appreciate you staying on from over an hour tonight. This is a
yes. One last thing that you may want to ask of Jamil in particular, because he's been the leading force behind this, is the Nate Fick confirmation. Jamil just wrote a letter in support of his confirmation to be the new cyber ambassador. I signed on to that letter, but you may want to turn over to Jamil to talk a little bit about Nate, because I think it's a very timely issue, and Nate is a terrific individual that should get a hearing in the Senate.
Yeah, that's great. So just to preface for people that are coming in, Nate Fick was recently nominated to serve as the State Department's first ambassador for cybersecurity and digital policy. Jamil, what are your thoughts on the nomination and the bigger picture cyber threats that are facing the U.S. and this administration?
Well, look, I think Nate's a great nominee. He's a Marine, CEO, a former CEO of Endgame, now at Elastic, and you know, a former leader of the Center for New American Security here in D.C., a think tank. So he's got the policy chops, the military chops, and the cyber background to really understand this issue. He's going to push, I think, the envelope on diplomacy. He's going to be the point person in the State Department for leading our efforts to bring together that coalition on cyber issues, both from a nation state perspective in Europe, but also in the Asian theater. This cannot be at a more important time. We're seeing an increasing range of threats, a diversity of threats from China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, but also non-state actors and, frankly, state-affiliated actors, all these Russian ransomware gangs that we know are operating at some level with the tacit approval, if not the direct approval and tasking of the Russian government, as well. And the Chinese are doing more in this space. We're seeing increasing relationships in that domain as well. So I think Nate is the right person for this job, because he brings this combination of capabilities. We have 106 national security and industry experts, including the CEO of Palo Alto Networks, General Stanley McChrystal, Dimitri, General Keith Alexander, the former director of NSA, and a range of other folks who signed on to this letter. The hearing is tomorrow before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm hopeful that the Senate will move swiftly on the nomination. And when they come back, as I expect they will in September before they recess to campaign for elections, that they will hopefully they'll vote on his nomination and get him through, because we need a strong, tough voice. And then one last point I'll make, which is, we've seen the administration sort of, pivot a little bit away from the offensive cyber posture that the Trump administration had taken, which was delegating a lot of authority down to cyber command and the like. The administration appears, at least from public reporting, to be bringing back more of an interagency, feel to that. That's not necessarily a bad thing from some people's perspective. I tend to think the constraint isn't that necessary. But I think that Nate's the right person at the State Department to sort of, engage in that conversation about when the right time is to use the cyber tool, if and when we need to, in a warfighting scenario or even in that below actual warfare scenario. Back to you, Dimitri.
Yeah. So guys, as I was saying, also for listeners, people that are in this call that may not be familiar with Hidden Forces, we've done so many episodes on these subjects. Of course, Dmitry Alperovich has been on the podcast twice, as I mentioned. Elbridge, who was on earlier and left, was also on recently. For cybersecurity, Chris Painter was on. Chris, of course, established the Office of the Coordinator for Cyber Issues and worked at the NSC. Chris Brose has been on the podcast to talk about innovation in the military and the work they're doing at Otteril. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter was on the podcast. So we've had tons of these episodes, We've done episodes dedicated to Taiwan. I've probably done over almost nearly 100 podcasts on geopolitics. So I've been very fortunate to speak with a lot of these brilliant people, like the people you heard on this call today. So I definitely recommend going to hiddenforces.io and checking that out. And of course, again, as I mentioned, Dimitri is at Silverado Policy Accelerator, also has a new podcast. Dimitri, what's the name of your podcast and where can people find that?
Yeah, it's called Geopolitics Decanted. You can find it pretty much anywhere, Apple, Amazon, Google, Spotify, etc. Podcast.silverado.org as well. And we have a great episode coming out this week on we've been doing a lot of deep analysis of the war in Ukraine, various dimensions of it, the military dimension. We did an episode last week on the energy factor and how Russia is using energy, what their master plan is to use energy to blackmail Europe in particular, and the serious trouble that Europe is in, without lots of options, great options, frankly. So check that out, and more to come from that.
Yeah, and I do want to say this as someone that actually is a podcaster, whereas Dimitri is officially not. I can tell you guys that he has been phenomenal. I mean, Dimitri, you've been a phenomenal communicator on the whole Ukraine story, man, from the very beginning, from before the beginning. And your Sunday night sessions with Michael Kaufman were just phenomenal. Such an important resource for me and so many other people in the media. And again, I do want to shout out Elbridge, even though he's not here, and give a shout out for his book, Strategy of Denial, a phenomenal book. Again, he was the lead architect of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, a really important contributor to this conversation. So thank you guys so much. Thank you, Jamil, for jumping on the call. Thank you, Chris, for offering a really important and interesting question. And I wish you all a great night.
Thank you.
Thanks.
For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to full episodes, transcripts, and intelligence reports, which include additional notes, resources, links, and other material that will help you get the most out of each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website at hiddenforces.io. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nicolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.